All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate.
This week and last on the Michael Slate Show, I've been sharing important interviews on immigrants and refugees. The Trump-Pence regime has been carrying out the ethnic cleansing of Latinos, including separating families and putting children in concentration camps, targeting activists who oppose their plans, ending DACA and temporary protected status, denying passports to U.S. citizens with Latino backgrounds, and now whipping up their fascist supporters and making all kinds of fresh threats around the refugee caravan currently in Mexico. A fascist form of rule is being implemented step by step. The Muslim ban is in effect. There is a fascist majority on the Supreme Court. There are new moves against LGBTQ people. What there is not is millions of people in the streets opposing all of this. So at the back end of the show, we'll be hearing an interview with Robin Reinecke, the co-founder and executive director of the Calibri Center for Human Rights. Robin talks about the families being separated at the border, not only by detention practices, but also by the death and disappearances that are the intended result of policies designed to inflict maximum suffering on the people. Before that, we'll hear an excerpt from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution, a speech by Bob Avakian, which premiered online October 19th. This is Bob Avakian's answer to people who complain that the immigrants are crossing the border. And opening the show up,
I'm really excited about this because we're going to be joined today by Betsy Ginsburg. And Betsy's joining us to talk about the widespread practice of banning books from prisons, the importance of the case of Blood in the Water, and why it's so important to fight this censorship. Betsy's a clinical associate professor of law at Benjamin N. Cardoza School of Law and the founder and director of the Civil Rights Clinic. The clinic focuses on civil rights and criminal justice and provides representation to individuals and groups whose civil rights have been violated by law enforcement officials. The clinic primarily litigates cases involving police misconduct and the constitutional and statutory rights of prisoners and detainees in federal court. And prior to her present position, Betsy Ginsburg taught at New York University School of Law and worked as a staff attorney with the Prisoners' Rights Project at the Legal Aid Society. Betsy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. We're going to jump into this because I'm looking at, like, just so you're ready, I have 18 pages of questions, okay?
All right.
Yeah. We'll be here till tomorrow. Okay. No, but there's quite a bit I want to dig into. Let's start with, and I'm sort of starting with what a lot of people might think would be the ending, but I want to start with this. Let's start with the importance of books in prison and to prisoners, because this is something that I want the people to know, the importance of books in prison and the importance to prisoners.
All books, and I think in particular this book, are really important to people who are inside prisons. I think for many of the same reasons that books are important to all of us, books are important to people who are in prison, but it's heightened because prisoners live in isolation from their communities. They lack access to educational resources. They often lack personal connections, especially if they're housed in solitary confinement. They often live in bleak, violent, harsh settings. And so books offer a way to stay connected to the outside world. They allow people to find hope and meaning through different kinds of books. They allow for escape. I don't mean literal escape, but escape through entering different times and worlds through books. They allow for education. There's really scant resources in our prisons for providing meaningful educational programming to people who are in prison. And a lot of prisoners rely on books to self-educate.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's almost the case, though, that the system, you know, the system treats books actually as dangerous weapons, you know, and I kept thinking about, you know, the way that people, I knew a lot of people in prison who when they, you know, they would be raided at night or they'd come in and they'd throw their cots over and they take everything. And they would purposely take whatever books people had managed to compile. They would do these things that indicated that they actually saw how dangerous a book in the hand of someone looking for answers could be.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's certainly seen as dangerous. And maybe there is fear of prisoners becoming educated. And of course, I think that fear that there's any danger to that is completely unfounded. And probably the opposite is true, which is that we see things like decreased violence or decreased recidivism rates for people who have higher literacy. I think there's also a lot of power dynamics there. I think people who who do this understand that these books are precious to people who are in prison, and it's a way to exert power.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the other thing that comes to mind, too, very sharply, is the whole idea, you know, trying to keep people from being able to read, trying to keep people from being able to explore the world and different views of it and to figure out what's going on. Actually, you think about, I was thinking about this right away in terms of the, you know, you look at the situation with slaves in the 1800s and before that, and continuing down to a certain extent to what goes on in public schools today, where people are not, you know, when we're talking about slaves, they were not allowed to read. And it was in part the danger of what you were just talking about. But even now today, where there's not the emphasis on, you know, children being pushed around, look, reading, it's important, do it. You know, and there's this disparaging thing. And I think there's a lot of commonality between what was happening to the slaves not being able to read and what's happening today.
Yeah, I think it's one of the many parallels one could draw between slavery and the modern prison system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, let's talk about this a little bit, because this, you know, I don't know how much people understand that this is the scope of the problem. When you talk about that, it's extreme. I mean, I was surprised because the amount of places and the amount of free will, you know, free will that's exercised by the authorities about, you know, you can have somebody in way out in the woods in a prison way out in nowhere in Indiana or something saying, okay, you're not allowed to do this, you know. We don't have to let you have this book or this book or this book. And there's both this pattern. There's a pattern that's actually been established of only certain books should be allowed in. And then there's another thing where it's wide open and sort of the authorities get to pick and choose what you can read and who can read.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of different problems relating to the restriction of reading materials, right? And so there's one that I think you're talking about, which is banning books based on their content, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what the Illinois lawsuit about Blood in the Water is about. And then there's other restrictions that are placed that I think are equally damaging and dangerous, which is, you know, the kind of restriction that says, well, you can only read books on an e-reader that you have to purchase through our vendors. Or if you go into solitary confinement, you can have one book or you can have no books with you. And all of those are ways in which the prison system is restricting prisoners' access to books. They're doing it in very different ways and for very different reasons, mostly under the guise of security of the institution. But all of those things, I think, are happening right now in lots of different places in a way that I think is really dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You know, one of the things I was thinking about in reading up on this, the approach to banning itself is in a way, it's part of the punishment of prisoners, it seems. Like on one level, there's a certain haphazardness to what gets banned and why, which seems it would almost be part, you know, at the same time, it almost seems like it's part of the punishing of the prisoners themselves.
I think that's certainly true. I think there's a sense of, you know, you're in prison and you should be restricted and that happens. I think the prison authorities wouldn't necessarily consider it to be punishment. They're using these mechanisms as a way for them to, at least what they say, is create safety and security. Although if you look more carefully at all of these different kinds of regulations, it sort of falls apart for a lot of different reasons.
Hmm. Like what? Actually, I'm curious about that.
Yeah. So, for example, and I really can't speak to why Illinois specifically has banned or disallowed Blood in the Water in some of its prisons, but, you know, as the lawsuit says, it allowed for the book to come into one of the prisons. I think it was Statesville, right, but not into two of the other prisons. All mm-hmm. three prisons were maximum security prisons. My sense is that they're disallowing that book because they think it would cause a threat to safety, right? It's a book about a prison uprising, and while I don't think that giving prisoners the education on the history of what happened in this country is in any way a threat to the prison, I think that would be the reason that would be provided, or the reason that would typically be provided in a situation like this. But clearly, they didn't think that to be the case and allowed it in at Statesville, right? So that, I think, falls apart there. You know, there's, I think, been some notion, and this certainly happened here in New York, and we're seeing it happen right now in the Pennsylvania system, that the prison authorities are concerned that somehow allowing books to come in from different sources, whether it's family members or organizations, charitable organizations that provide books to prisoners, that somehow it's going to facilitate the entry of contraband, like drugs or weapons, into the facility. And I guess there I would say there have, you know, certainly what many people understand to be the greatest cause of contraband and weapons and drugs coming into prisons are in fact staff, people who work at the prisons who are not screened in the way that family members and even lawyers are screened who go in. And so they don't take that problem seriously when it's coming through their own people, but it's easy enough for them to do things like ban books in the name of preventing the entry of that material.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Betsy Ginsburg. Betsy is a clinical associate professor of law at Benjamin N. Cardoza School of Law and the founder and director of the Civil Rights Clinic there. Betsy, let's talk about this because, you know, when you're saying that, it's true. I think there's actually, you know, when you look at like all the books when you, on these various websites and stuff and these different people have been, there's actually a lot of people paying attention to what's going on in terms of the prisoners and the right to have knowledge to actually pursue something that would help them understand the world and what they're living in and how to change it, how to get out of this. But there's also this thing of, so you have this one level where there's a certain haphazardness about what gets banned. And it is wacky when you see things like, you know, I can't remember, was it like Homer Simpson or the Flintstones? And then, you know, they're banned and then something else is allowed. And there's all these things that are just like, there's a certain sort of wackiness to it that keeps things on edge and off balance. And yet at the same time, there are very specifically targeted books that are being banned. And I thought it was interesting, you know, both talking about that and then at the same time, the fact that things that aren't banned are things that come from the Nazis and, the KKK and stuff like that, that are actually in a number of prisons are actually openly said, well, these are okay for these guys to get and read. And it's the exact opposite of everything else that they're banning all the time.
I think that's right. And you see that in a lot of systems throughout the country. Books like Mein Kampf are permitted, whereas books like Blood in the Water and some other books that are, you know, I think often there's some, I think, bit of race coloring some of this, right? So, you know, you'll see a lot of books by Black authors about rebellion that are banned, and you don't see that in books as stark as Mein Kampf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what would you say around, I mean, here's the thing. Let's dig into the particularities of Heather and her book. You know, you look at this, the book on the Attica Uprising and all the dark secrets that have been kept from people until this book came out. I mean, it really is. And having, you know, been in college when Attica happened and, you know, having followed it and been at demonstrations around it and understanding, you know, what I thought I understood then. But even as much as we understood the horrors of that and who was responsible, there was still a cloud that hung over that and was purposely sort of held down by the authorities for many, many years until Heather got into this book and really started to tear things apart.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that is part of what is potentially behind at least some of the banning of this book. And, you know, this book is not universally banned in prisons. That prisoners in other parts of the country have had the opportunity to read the book. But I certainly think something about, you know, about the fact that this book does dig much deeper into what happened. I think Heather worked on this book for more than a decade, really working hard to get certain documents released, even if many of them were released with very heavy redactions. And so bringing a lot of sunlight to a topic where, you know, we knew some of what happened, but certainly not as much as what's in her really comprehensive account of what happened at Attica. And I think for a lot of people who work in corrections, Attica doesn't necessarily have the same meaning as it does certainly for me, and I think for you, which is that it was in some ways similar to the prison strike you mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is it's really bringing what happens inside of prisons to the outside world, really showing people what's going on inside prisons. And these are very much closed institutions, and we don't, you know, get news cameras in there, and we don't, you know, see what's happening on a daily basis inside. And so I think there's tremendous fear into opening that up, and books like this really, in some ways, open that up, right? I mean, of course, it's over 40 years ago that this happened, and so there's no sense that somehow it's going to provide a blueprint for exactly, you know, how to, you know, take over a prison by a prisoner. But I do think it's that sort of shedding sunlight on what goes on in prisons is something that I think there's great fear of.
Mm-hmm. No, we're running up on our time, but I really want to get this in. In a way, you know, there's this whole point about that books are dangerous weapons to the powers that be. I mean, this is something that, you know, people, I think, a little too often, you know, sort of allude to that, but don't really get that actually there's a real big truth to that fact that books are dangerous weapons to the powers that be, and all kinds of dangerous ideas can take shape in people's minds once they start reading and exploring what's possible in the world. Let's talk about this a little bit, because, you know, just why is this so important? Why is it so important that this not be allowed to fall down like this? Why is it so important that people actually recognize what's going on? And one, read the book and spread it and pay attention to what's happening into the people imprisoned right now.
I mean, I think there's a few reasons why it's so important. I think one of them is just what you say, which is, bringing attention to what's happening. We're housing so many people inside prisons. We're not doing a good job of anything, right? We're not necessarily doing a good job of deterring crime. We're not helping rehabilitate people. Why are we warehousing all of these people here, and under what conditions are we doing it? And so I do think it's critical for people to understand that. I think also what this issue and the case that Heather has brought highlight is the importance of access to reading materials, and in general having this right to access reading materials. And people who are in prison don't have the same right as the rest of us under the First Amendment to read what we want to read, but they have some rights. And the Constitution doesn't just disappear at the prison door, as many courts have said, but yet we need to fight hard to enforce that, because all over the place, prisons are restricting this right and the reading materials.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, and it's interesting because there is this whole point of, I mean, look, really, when you think about this, the fact that actually the role that being able to explore the world, being able to do things like read books and all this, you know, this is actually, it's critical in terms of people, I think, in terms of people's life. You know, it's really critical in terms of people's lives and, you know, their ability to explore, even if while they're sitting in prison, to explore reality and what's going on here and what's happening. You think about this. You think about the transition Malcolm X made. You know, Malcolm X really came alive from when he was reading inside prisons, and when he began to understand all the ways that the system is working and began to try and figure out what are the ways to stand up against this. And it seems to me that this is something that's really important when people get to see a book like Heather's book. You know, it's an incredible, incredible. I mean, when I read it, I was just really moved by it. The Blood in the Water is one of the finest books that I've read in a long time, and I think it's something that's really, really important. This is the kind of thing I think people need to actually look at, understand what's going on, and basically step into it.
I think that's right. I've been working with people in prison for 20 years, and it's something I hear uniformly from people that I speak with and clients, which is the importance of books. And, you know, they want to talk about the books they've read, and it's really something that I think keeps their hope alive, keeps their minds alive, and brings them joy. So, I think you can't really overstate that importance.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Betsy.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. And look forward to talking to you again sometime. Keep in touch with us. All right. Okay. All right. Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Betsy Ginsburg. Betsy is a clinical associate professor of law at Benjamin N. Cardoza School of Law and the founder and director of the Civil Rights Clinic. The clinic focuses on civil rights and criminal justice and provides representation to individuals and groups whose civil rights have been violated by law enforcement officials.
Since I was speaking to Betsy about the Attica prison uprising, its historical importance, and the attempts of the powers that be to suppress the true history of Attica, I wanted to play some sound from that uprising. So this is part of a statement during the uprising made by one of the leaders, L.D. Barclay.
This is something many people today have never even heard of. This is what they're afraid of. Check this out.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to this situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who would enslave and exploit the people of America.
Sisters and brothers, that was L.D. Barclay, one of the leaders of the Attica Rebellion. L.D.
Barclay was killed when the rebellion was suppressed by the state, but he did not die during the initial attack. He was captured, but that same night, he was assassinated in cold blood by officers. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back.
Amazing disgrace when they brought us to this godforsaken place. They raped our mothers, incarcerated our fathers, stole all the land. But in spite of all that, everything will be okay. And that's a natural fact. But nobody will never, they will never be free until they free me and we, me and we.
Now we're going to hear from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, in an excerpt from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution, which is available now online at revcom.us. That's R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M.us.
My name is Michelle.
My name is Alex.
And we're with the Revolution Club in Los Angeles. And you're about to watch this clip from a Q&A with Bob Avakian. And we're releasing this clip because of the situation at the border right now, where you have thousands of immigrants that are fleeing for their lives and they're coming to this country. And you have fascist Donald Trump that's threatening to send the U.S. military to the border. And he's telling the Mexican military to stop the caravan from coming to this country. And so you're about to watch a very powerful clip where Avakian speaks to why it is that immigrants come to this country.
This Q&A took place after a speech that was given by Bob Avakian over the summer, Why We Need an Actual Revolution, How We Can Really Make Revolution. That was just launched, and you can find it at revcom.us. If you hate the state of the world right now and the way the world is, and you're agonizing about it, and you want a better world brought into being, then you gotta watch this film and spread it.
And this clip you're about to watch is part of a longer answer that was given by Avakian, where he was asked to speak to the negative international situation.
Well, I thought you did a good job of presenting the bleak picture in the world. the situation in the world is terrible. Okay, let's just be honest. I mean, there are a lot of potential things that are, you know, the potential positive things that do exist in the real world, you know, so to speak. But the situation now is very bad. It's an expression of you know, these oppressive societies, all the ones you mentioned, you know, obviously including the U.S., you know, feeling strains, you know, experiencing strains and certain crises. And, you know, to go back to the Laura Ingrams and the Tucker Carlson's and the rest of them on you know, the fascists on Fox, there is a real sense in which the world, you know, the world and the countries of, you know, as these people have known them, are, you know, being objectively transformed and to a significant degree torn apart in ways that are, you know, that have brought forward, you know, these fascist forces. You know, the, you know, I talked to, you know, at the beginning in part one about all, you know, these five stops and the, for example, the close interconnection between what's happening with the environment and, you know, the immigrant crisis, you know, which is greater than what the than what's caused by, you know, in the environmental crisis. But, you know, it's a massive phenomenon. People on the move, you know, in huge numbers, you know, I mean, 65 million people is a tremendous number of people to be immigrants and refugees without a home, basically. And, you know, it is in certain ways, you know, overwhelming or at least challenging the, you know, what has been the existing bourgeois and oppressive societies as they've existed up to now in these countries, you know, you know, all that is being greatly played on and greatly exaggerated by these fascist forces. But there's some reality to it. You know, my feeling is, you know, and my answer to all these people who complain about all the immigrants coming, you know, across the border, many of them illegally, like, say, into the U.S. Well, okay, then. Give up everything that you know, every parasitic benefit that you get from everything that's caused these immigrants to do this in the first place. And then after you've done that, then come back and see if you want to complain about the immigrants. Because this you can't have it both ways. You know, they want to have it both ways, but you can't. You want to have all the plunder and all the destruction and all the disruption and all the upheaval that your system causes and all the exploitation, including of little children, all around the world, which wreaks havoc in these countries. And then you want to complain when the people come here. No, you cannot have it both ways, mother. I mean, look at the Congo. Many people don't know much about what's happening in the Congo, but they should. You know, in the past couple of decades in the Congo, more than 5 million people have died in these internecine, you know, conflicts within the Congo. And you could sit there and say, oh, another shithole country, look what the people are doing to each other. But just as what's happening in the inner cities among the black and brown people and the youth in particular here, on a much more massive scale, what's happening in a place like the Congo is directly attributable to what the imperialist system has done there over more than 100 years. I mean, I'll get back to more directly to what you were raising, but this is part of the world picture, too, that's very important. I mean, do you know, for example, how many people know? I sometimes like to pose these questions. You go on a college campus, and you ask people who are graduate students and professors, for example, what percentage of people would know the answer to this question? Under the rule of Leopold, King Leopold of Belgium, who ran the Congo at the end of the 19th century and into the next, you know, as a personal preserve, out of the 20 million people or so who lived in the Congo during those times, what percentage were killed under the rule of Leopold? Somewhere between 7 and 10 of the 20 million, almost a half of the population. Almost nobody knows about this. Think about that. They were put to work under the most horrific conditions, mining rubber and other things, and if they didn't meet the quotas or in some other way they were considered a problem, they had their hands cut off if they weren't killed. This is what, you know, the great enlightened Western imperialism was doing in this one country. And then, finally, after World War II, when there was an independence struggle in the Congo, and you got Patrice Lumumba came forward as a popular nationalist leader and became the leader of the Congo, what happened? The U.S. imperialists moved to get rid of Lumumba, The CIA and the rest of them worked to get him captured by opposing forces that were their puppets, basically, and he was assassinated. And what did they? What came out of all that? Mobutu, who was kept in power by the U.S. for 4 decades, plundering the country and as a puppet of the U.S. for 4 decades, and subjecting the massive people there to terrible conditions. And this is why the Congo is such a mess now. And millions more people are dying. So don't f***ing complain to me about immigrants coming across the border illegally, okay? Just shut the f*** up about immigrants coming across the border illegally. Look what you have done to the people in the world. And you have the nerve to complain about people coming here trying to get a job so they can feed their family, and calling them rapists and murderers and so on. But there are a lot of strains objectively on all these countries that you mentioned. Isn't it wonderful? Look, the Soviet Union was no good for decades. It was a capitalist, in fact, even when it was socialist in name, and it was social imperialist from the mid-50s on. In other words, socialist in name, but imperialist in reality. But isn't it wonderful that finally, all these Eastern European countries have been freed from the domination of the Soviet Union? Aren't wonderful things happening under the rule of these bourgeoisies in all these countries, like Hungary and these other places, or Poland, and all the, fascists rising to power, essentially? And this is what's happening in response to these great changes that are taking place in the world, including the immigrant crisis, is contributing to this. It's a fascist response to the immigrant crisis, as well as other factors. A revolutionary response would be to absorb massive people coming and make them become part of the positive force transforming the society. But the imperialists can't do that, and the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, and the capitalist system can't do that. So they both exploit them, or super exploit them in intense exploitation, and particularly the fascist forces within the ruling circles seize on this to build up a whole fascist backlash against these immigrants who were there because of the havoc that's been wreaked on their country, on their own countries, fundamentally because of the workings of imperialism in terms of the effect on the environment, as well as the wars and the general disruption. I cited the example of NAFTA and what happened there, but you could go, many countries, and back in 2003, I cited the example of, in a talk, revolution talk back then, I cited the example of Jamaica and how many farmers there were ruined by the subsidizing of milk from the U.S., which, and the same thing happened in Haiti. You can go on revcom.us and read about Haiti and how the agricultural economy of the peasants in Haiti was ruined by the penetration and dominance of the U.S. and the particular policies that were created there. So again and again and again, this is what's causing, both this tremendous upheaval and chaos in the world and in countries throughout the world. And it's also, what is giving rise, or a big factor giving rise to these fascist movements that you're talking about.
What you just heard needs to be spread everywhere. Nobody's talking about why it is that the immigrant people are coming into this country the way that Baba Bacon breaks it down. Nobody's talking about how the U.S. f***s over the rest of the world and makes people leave their country, leave their family, and risk their lives to come into this country. And everything that we're hearing is all this bullshit and all this slander from these fascists, and these threats coming down from this fascist regime. This is an urgent time, and everybody needs to understand the situation that we're in and how we're actually gonna stop this. We need a revolution, and everybody needs to join in making this revolution. Get this film out everywhere. Go watch the whole film. It is the most scientific analysis that we have, and we have a strategy and the leadership to do that. So go and watch this film, join the revolution, go to refcom.us.
Why we need an actual revolution, and how we can really make revolution.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, in an excerpt from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And it was his answer to people who complain about immigrants crossing the borders. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Robin Reinecke, so stay tuned. That was City of Immigrants by Steve Earle. My next guest is Robin Reinecke.
Somebody I met at Sundance when she was helping, or she was part of a film that had been made there about finding bodies in the desert and the quest to find out who those people were and get to their families. And her name is Robin Reinecke. She's the co-founder and executive director of the Calibri Center for Human Rights. And when we were talking back then, it was sort of something that really stuck in my mind. And I just recently read a piece that Robin had written, and it was about family separations and how it's forever and death and disappearance and the U.S. government's policies designed to inflict maximum suffering. And I'm just going to jump into it because I have so many things to ask you. Robin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. It's good to talk with you again, Michael.
Yeah, you too. So let's jump into this. You've spent 11 years documenting immigrant deaths along the border, and you've described the situation as one of the more silent, invisible human rights catastrophes in the world. Give people a sense of what you're talking about there.
Thanks for that question. Yeah, I'm standing here right now in the courtyard of the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner in Tucson, Arizona, and it is mid-July, gonna get to be over 100 today. Thankfully, the monsoons have started, so the worst is over, but now it's humid. But this is the 12th year. The cicadas are quite loud, so if you hear that in the background, sorry. But the 12th summer that I've spent smelling the decomposed beds brought in from the desert every single day. And I wish I could translate to you all the feeling of watching that unfold. You know, we had a summer one July where it was two bodies a day. You know, watching the database click along and another record comes in for a young woman's remains found in southern Arizona, highly decomposed, a skull found by hikers, Border Patrol driving along and hearing a crunch and looking down and finding a human skull under the tire. Tohono O'odham people on the native land going outside in their backyard, and their dog has something strange in its mouth, and it's part of a human hand. This is what it's felt like here, being present in Tucson over the last more than a decade. And it's not just me, but hundreds of people who are involved in providing aid and trying to save people's lives, bandaging feet, putting out water, at this point in time now being increasingly deterred from doing that and those humanitarian actions being criminalized. So what I mean when I say invisible and erased humanitarian human rights catastrophes, part of what I'm pointing to is just there's a shocking nature of seeing a dead body. At this point in my life, what's even more shocking is that we are seeing this many dead and we're still not talking about it as a nation. We're still not really concerned and having a national dialogue about the fact that in southern Arizona alone, an average of 175 bodies are found in and around where I live. So to me, that's the bigger crisis and the more shocking thing. It's not only the loss of life, but it's the fact that there doesn't seem to be outrage about it. So I'm hopeful that there's some outrage about family separation being perpetrated by the Trump administration right now. And I just really hope that we can translate that discussion into a broader conversation about human rights violations and violence along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a comment that you make in this article that you wrote where you're talking about your work trying to identify a young man from Guatemala. And you're using a video to help you do that. And it just really struck me. I mean, I had to read this like two or three times just to get the full, you know, just to comprehend the horror of this. You say that there's this picture of this smiling young guy, and your task was identifying his teeth. So you kept stopping the picture. You kept stopping the photo and looking. And so you could identify his teeth so you might be able to identify his skull, who he was. I can't imagine the horror in that. And it really concentrates something about the inhumanity that is being concentrated there. And what's being said about the people there and their humanity.
Yeah, so that I'm standing now looking into the lunchroom at the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner, kind of an old county office, not that fancy. But I used to take lunch breaks every day with my mentor and my teacher, Dr. Bruce Anderson, the forensic anthropologist here. And there used to be a TV, a little, you know, old TV and a VHS player set up in the lunchroom. And his colleague loved to watch Judge Judy, so that would often be on at lunchtime. But we got a missing persons report. We got a call from a mother, Fermina, who was searching for her son, who was 14 years old, Nelson Omar, who she had left in Guatemala to try to keep him safe and at home. She migrated north to send money back so that he could have hopes of education, and she thought she could defend him and take care of him better with more financial resources. So she migrated to the U.S. Nelson had been missing her for a long time, but then his home situation became increasingly unsafe. So he decided to leave and head north from Guatemala to join his mom. An older neighbor, a woman about 50 years old, joined him on the journey. And they both disappeared together. So Fermina, Nelson's mom, called me at the time. I was a volunteer learning under the forensic anthropologist here. And I took down information, and I hate asking this question, but I asked her, can you describe his teeth, or do you have any smiling photographs of him? And the reason that we have to ask that is because so many of the remains are so highly decomposed or skeletal that there's no hope of identifying them without either DNA or dental records. These people are so impoverished that I already knew that she probably wouldn't have dental records, but maybe she would have a photograph. She said, I don't have a good smiling photo, but Nelson did send me a VHS tape, like a greeting that they had recorded of Nelson smiling and saying hi to his mom so that she could see a video of him because they missed each other. She sent us that VHS tape. And Bruce and I went into the lunchroom, and we put that in the VHS player and sat there and fought back tears and tried to pause the tape when this little cute kid is smiling, because skeletal remains had been found together of an older woman in her 50s and a young boy probably under 15. And so we were finally able to positively identify those remains as those of Nelson's and this older woman that was trying to protect him. But it took 2 years until their remains were found in the desert.
Boy. I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Robin Reinecke, and she's co-founder and executive director of the Colibri Center for Human Rights. And we're talking about family separation is forever, death and disappearance, and the U.S. government's policies designed to inflict maximum suffering. I'm telling you, Robin, I just really had to get up really early this morning because it was
it got to a point where it's just too much to think about this thing in a certain sense, in terms of the descriptive way that you've put this stuff. And it's important that people understand this. And one of the things that you've spoken to is that how families are separated today through both detention and death and disappearance. And you say that both of these aren't like separate things. One's not better than the other, or one's not worse than the other. You say both of these are the results of policies that are specifically designed to inflict maximum suffering. Let's talk about that.
Right. So the Trump administration right now is increasing and doubling down upon and exacerbating in very extreme ways human rights abuses along the border. But we have to take a look at some of the underlying logic and the underlying strategies that predate Trump. So one of the biggest ones that we are aware of very painfully every day in southern Arizona is just a strategy called prevention through deterrence on the U.S.-Mexico border. So there was a 1994, this is under the Clinton administration, policy document that was co-written between then INS, precursor to ICE, kind of, co-written with the Center for Low-Intensity Conflict. And it was a 1994 Border Patrol strategic plan, and it outlined this strategy that they called prevention through deterrence. And that was basically a theory that the more deadly, the more risky, the more dangerous, the more expensive that an undocumented border crossing became, the idea was the fewer people would try to take it. So it's almost like a moat, like thinking of the U.S.-Mexico border as a moat or as a deadly zone to try to deter people from crossing that territory. In a few short years, it was already clear that strategy of, you know, closing off the safe kind of places where people would try to jump under the fence or run across the highway, those areas became very heavily patrolled. And what was left open, well, more or less open, were the very remote and dangerous expanses of the desert. And in this policy document, it says we want to basically use the geography strategically, the searing heat of the desert geography of the Southwest, the searing heat. It said that people crossing that area would find themselves in mortal danger. Under assumptions, the plan listed violence will increase as effects of strategy are felt. So there were all of these assumptions that they were going to basically hinge human suffering. They were going to connect human suffering to the policies of border enforcement. People would be punished physically for trying to cross that border. So that's the whole kind of theory and strategy behind prevention through deterrence. And so fast forward 20 years and easily 10,000 deaths and no significant dip in overall migration along the border that can be correlated. And this is pretty statistically rigorously backed up in research. So the strategy did increase deaths. It didn't significantly or in any meaningful way decrease overall migration. And yet, here we are in 2018, and we're hearing the Trump administration, at least three officials have cited deterrence as trying to explain their strategy of why they're separating families. Kirsten Nelson mentioned deterrence. Sessions mentioned deterrence. Trump himself has mentioned deterrence, and others in the administration have mentioned deterrence. And to me, it's a really sick and violent idea because it's basically saying it's a dehumanizing theory that justifies inflicting harm on someone in the name of security, which I find like very, how can something be secure where there's thousands of deaths there every year? So I think we need to take a look at prevention through deterrence as a strategy. And, you know, it's very different what's happening on the border than, you know, people use the analogy of someone trying to break into their house. It's a very, very different context where you have, you know, 100-year or more history of people crossing across that border for work and being invited to do so. And then you've got a family separation issue. And then you've got people trying to flee violence, whether it's domestic violence or gang violence. So it's a real different context than personal security concerns.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, and you started to refer to this, but there's another way that this works too, which is actually when people are looking for their loved ones, whether they're still back in their home country, the people looking for them, or whether they're here, and they're trying to, especially if they're here, they're trying to actually figure out, okay, what happened to my husband, to my sister, to my wife, to my daughter, my son, you know, because people disappear and for years no one's heard from and no one knows whether these people are alive or dead. And anytime there's a fear and a price to pay, it seems, if you step forward, and a lot of people think this way too, and righteously so, because they're familiar with what it means if these Nazis come up and grab you and you're done, you know. And so this whole sort of price you have to pay to even search for your loved one.
Right. It exposes people to a lot of risk when they start to search for their loved ones. And I can't overestimate how devastating it is to have your son disappear, or your father, or your sister. Time stops. In the short term, families struggle to eat and sleep, go to work. If you can just imagine how terrifying that would be, or if any of you are parents and you've lost track of your kid for even just 10 minutes at a park or something like that, it's pure terror. I mean, there's a reason why some violent dictatorships such as Argentina in the past enforced disappearance as a strategy of torture to suppress political action. It's incredibly psychologically and socially damaging. So these families are really suffering without information. And then on top of it, many of them are undocumented or themselves in economically or security-wise, you know, insecure situations in Central America or Southern Mexico. And so they're searching for their kid, and that search can kind of open them up to further abuses or to being, you know, a lot of the families that we talk to are extorted, or they're told, we have your daughter and we're going to kill her unless you wire us over $5,000. So the families are in a really horrible situation, and Colibri Center for Human Rights is one of a small handful of groups along the border trying to respond. And, you know, my personal political analysis is that this is state violence being perpetrated along the border. But whether or not you agree with me on that, I dearly hope that you can recognize the humanity of people to the extent that they should know what happened to their kid, regardless of what their kid was doing, that they should be able to know what happened. They should be able to bury their child, that those bones shouldn't just be left out in the desert forever, that they should be cared for like we would care for anyone among us as a human being. So Colibri works hard and diligently to do that, to bring answers to the families. And I will tell you right now, we are absolutely inundated. We're a staff of four. This is political work. It's hard to fund. We're a staff of four with a backlog of 700 people at this moment. So that's 700 people who basically left us a voicemail and are waiting for us to call them back.
And we only have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to speak to this. I think it's very powerful what we've been talking about, and we'll have you back again to talk about it more and follow it as it goes along. The death toll over 20 years, because that's something that, you know, there's sort of the denial of people's humanity folds down into even just not reporting on what the actual death toll is in relation to this. So people have an idea of, we're not talking about a person here, a person there. We're talking about a mass phenomenon here.
Yeah, so that 700 number that I cited, that's the number of people, you know, just calling us right around now and waiting for us to record their details. We have an additional 3,000 names in our database of people who've disappeared. Most of those are relevant to Arizona because that's where we're really focused. But then, so those are people who are missing, where the mother or whatever is waiting for news about her son who disappeared crossing. And then on the other side is the dead. So in southern Arizona, we're approaching 3,000 dead over the past 20 years, so starting 18 years, starting in 2000. About 1,000 of those are unidentified human remains. And then if you add in Texas, thousands more. And we don't even know how many people have actually died crossing. We don't know how many people have been recovered, because the only agency releasing any kind of comprehensive count is Border Patrol. Mm-hmm. And CNN, you can look it up. CNN did a really good investigative deep dive into how problematic and incomplete those numbers are. Mm-hmm. So I think it kind of touches again on the first thing that we talked about, how erased this entire crisis is. We as a nation, we aren't even taking the first step to at least just count how many have been found.
Mm-hmm. All right, Robin, I want to thank you for a very, very powerful interview today. And I also want you to give people the way that they want to get in contact with Colibri. Give them the contact information for that.
Thank you so much. www.colibricenter.org. That's colibricenter.org. And you can donate there, support our work, or just send us a note and encourage us. We appreciate it very much.
All right, Robin Reinecke, thank you very much for joining us today, and look forward to talking to you
thank
again
you.
Soon. All right,
thanks
take care
so
now. Bye.
You too. Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Robin Reinecke, co-founder and executive director of the Colibri Center for Human Rights. And we've been talking about family separation and death
at the hands of the U.S. government and its Border Patrol. Before I go, I want to make an announcement. This is from Refuse Fascism. Regardless of whether you voted, no matter who wins, we must be in the streets beginning the day after the midterm elections to demand and demonstrate our determination that in the name of humanity, the Trump-Pence regime must go. There are demonstrations called for Wednesday, November 7th, the day after the midterms, and protests again on Saturday, November 10th. To find a protest in your area, go to refusefascism.org. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Awakening from Leon Parker. Talk to you again next week.